You're listening to Booth Talk from the After Movie Diner. And on this episode, it is our distinct pleasure and honour to speak to an iconic actor, writer, director and ex-pro footballer, one of the most prominent leading men in the African-American movie explosion of the early 70s, the man Roger Ebert once described as a one-man movie machine. His name is Fred Williamson, but he wants you to call him The Hammer. Hi, Fred. This is John from the After Movie Diner.
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm good, sir. I'm good. And how are yourself?
Incredible.
Incredible. Excellent. You got time to have a few words with us today?
Had lots of time.
Excellent, man. Excellent. Well, it's a real thrill and pleasure to be on the phone with you. On the line with us as well, I've got my co-host for this episode, Mr. Paul Croson. He's on the line with us as well.
How are you, Mr. Williamson? Are you okay?
I'm good as can be.
Good.
Glad to hear it. So, can we start talking about the first original Gangsters and how that film came about?
My goal is to make films that people want to see and put people in a film that people want to see. So my idea was to put all the old school actors back together in a film and let them do what they're famous for. Let them play a part in what they're famous for. Hollywood doesn't seem to care about that. Hollywood moves on much too quickly than some actors want. So a lot of actors don't really get a chance to continue their character, like Jim Brown or Pam Grier or Bernie Casey. So I decided to put together a film called Original Gangsters. And that sort of sums up what we represent to the film industry in public, which is the OG. So I've develop a new name, a nickname, not that I need a new one for sure, but OG is now what they call me and Jim Brown and Pam Grier. We're original gangsters. So
nice.
I made a film. The story came from there was a vacant house next to where my mother lived in Gary, Indiana, and some drug dealers had moved in and selling dope and stuff from this vacant house. And one day their car was blocking the driveway. My mom couldn't get out, and she asked one of these guys to please move their car, and they said some very terrible things to her and threatened her. And some neighbor heard it while it was happening, called me in L.A. and said, you better come out here and help your mom because she's having some problems with some turkeys next door. So I flew back to Gary and got a couple of my buddies, Bubba and Junior, and yeah. We went by the door, knocked on the door. A guy came to the door. I said, is that your car? He said, yeah. I proceeded to pound on him, took him out to the street, took all his clothes off, and made him run down the street naked. So I said, you know, there's a movie here. This is a pretty good movie. I can come back home and protect people from vigilante youngsters. So that's how I came about doing Original Gangsters.
That's very cool, very cool. And so that incredible cast, are you all friends, or is it more like respected colleagues from a similar time in movie making who just want to work together again?
No, some of both, you know. I got golfing buddies with Jim Brown and Richard Roundtree, and always looking for some way to be close to Pam Grier. So,
of course.
You know, of course, I wanted to put together a film that I figured we all could have some fun in. And nothing is better when you do a film and you have all your buds with you. Then it becomes really a fun project.
Yeah, definitely. It's a great film. We love it. And Larry Cohen directing was obviously a nod to work you had both done in the 70s on Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem. Whose idea was that, and what was it like to be working with him again after so much time?
Well, since I produced the film and wrote the film, I had the power to select whoever I wanted. And it was payback for me to give Larry Cohen a chance to do a film because he hadn't done anything of that nature in a long time. So it was kind of a payback favor to bring Larry in and let him help direct it because he kind of knew everybody that was in the film and kind of knew their style and their characters. So I figured it'd be a good choice along with my help, of course.
Yeah, of course. And what if any were the major differences between making similar films in the 70s versus either the 90s or indeed now?
Well, my films from the 70s, from the beginning, never really fit into the genre of black exploitation. when they started making the films back in the early 70s, the black stars were getting jobs and working. Their films were basically retribution. Let's get whitey. Let's pay back whitey. My films were never like that. I beat up black people, yellow people, pink people, white people. I beat up everybody. If you were bad, you went down in one of my films. So I made sure that my image stayed intact, because what I was selling was integrity. I wasn't selling a guy to get back and consider retribution for being black. And that never entered my mind. I just wanted to make a good action film, a believable action film, a film where the special effects is not the star of the film, but more important, the characters, the people, how they walk, how they talk, how they interact with other people. That's what's important in the films that I make.
And how do you think that's changed in filmmaking between then and now?
Special effects is the star of the movie. You don't really care about people anymore. They don't need to. Why did they pay $10 million and $8 million for somebody to be in a film with a special effects to start a film? They got Angelina Jolie jumping out of an airplane on top of a moving truck and then jumping off the truck and running down the street. Come on, I mean, that's where the phase, come on, man, came from. When you sit there, especially when you watch it with a black audience, they sit there and you get a lot of those, come on, man.
Yeah.
You know, so I want to stay with something that's believable. You know, my idols were Clint Eastwood and Charles Bronson and Robert Mitchum and Robert Ryan. Those kind of guys, George Raff, Humphrey Bogart, these guys didn't need special effects to carry a film. Their character and their personality carried the film.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So you're currently in the process of a Kickstarter campaign for Old School Gangsters, the sequel. How did that come about?
Well, because I'm having so much trouble in Hollywood. Hollywood doesn't care about the projects that star black actors anymore. They just don't really care. So I have had problems trying to find money, trying to find financing for the film. So I understand that Kickstarter was the way to go. The only mistake that we made in Kickstarter was we did it over the holidays, and that was not a good choice. We should have waited later on. You know, there may be a miracle may happen. We still may make our goal, but if there's a possibility to, you know, kick it up again in a few months, I think that the timing was bad for it because of the holidays.
Yeah. Well, we're doing it all that we can, man. We're advertising it as much as we can on Twitter and Facebook and putting it out there where we can. And obviously, we're doing a whole, our two shows are doing a whole series of original gangster movies, old movies starring you guys, Jim Brown, Pam Grier, yourself, and so on. So we're trying to get the message out over January if we can and
It's Stallone copied it. That's why Stallone got his idea from the films that he's doing now, the Spendables, the Indispendables, whatever you call them.
Yeah.
Was bringing all his buds and bringing all these characters back in the film together that people were wondering what they were doing and where they were. And Stallone put them all in a movie and it became, you know, a picture for everybody to come see their favorite actor in one film. And that's really why, you know, this film needs to be made. It should be made so that people can see their stars.
Definitely. Well, we agree. And you've got a lot of the old cast coming back, but also some new faces from the old days, Antonio Fargas and Gloria Hendry. Is there anyone else from those classic films from the 70s and 80s that you want to get back for the film? Or?
Yeah, I got Gloria Hendry in it. Remember Gloria Hendry? She was a star back then. That's Pam Grier, Bernie Casey, Richard Roundtree, Antonio Fargas, Robert Forster. He's a friend.
Yeah.
So, you know, and whatever name that I can come up with, I might just throw him in as a cameo. You know, I'll fill it up. Once you get this film off the ground, it'll be easy for me to throw names in because everybody wants to be in this kind of film. That's a black actor or a black actress for sure, because the film has integrity and I don't make cheap looking films, and the films that I have, you know, stand up. For any filmmaker who likes good films, so for me to put other people in the film, it won't be a problem once we get it off the ground.
On the show this week, we're covering Three the Hard Way and One Down, Two to Go, films that have similar casts. Three the Hard Way was one of your first ensemble films. In that, you played up the reputation, talents, and attributes of its stars. How did that film come about?
We're looking for a vehicle at that particular time that would captivate a total audience, not because everybody was making so-called black films at that particular time. Again, my idea was not to make a black film, but make a film that had some credibility, even if the subject matter was black, but it wasn't a film shot in the ghetto. It was a film shot in many venues in New York, in Detroit, where Jim Brown and I lived, and Jim Kelly. So you put three guys together who have a reputation as badasses, you know there's going to be some fighting and some shooting. There's going to be no talking, or little talking as possible, just good action. So it was easy to understand what made that film work.
Oh, definitely. It's a non-stop action. It's great. The film appears like it's been filmed all over the country. Was that? Did you have to travel for the shoot, or was that just film trickery?
No, my goal is to make films around the world. My last 10, 20 films are all made around the world. I like to make films in locations like in Germany, in Italy, in Paris, in London, so that the black audiences who may never have a chance to travel there can live vicariously through us and watch us travel smooth through these countries without having any idea of being black or any idea of being prejudiced when you were in these countries. It's just one man seeking another bad guy or following some villain that you have to take out in Italy. So that's been my concept all along, is to make films for the world market and not just for the black market.
Excellent. Is there any funny stories from the making of the movie?
You ain't got that much time.
We've got all night, man.
Every time you put a whole bunch of celebrities and a whole bunch of stars together, you're going to have some conflicts. And those conflicts are good and they're interesting and they're healthy because they never really come to fruition. But there's a lot of threats and pushing and shoving and things that happen. But it's all things we laugh and talk about over dinner afterwards. You know, that we did this film called Take a Hard Ride with me and Jim Brown and Jim Kelly, which was a follow-up on Through the Hard Way. And it was one scene, we were walking across a bridge, and Jim Kelly's in front of me, and it was a rope bridge, so it was very narrow. Jim Kelly was in front of me, Jim Brown was behind me, and I was leading the horse. So we get across on the other side, and now Jim Brown is angry at me, peeling at me. And I said, "What's the problem with it?" He said, "Your goddamn horse was ass. It was in my face." I said, "My problem, man. Don't walk so close to the horse. Don't do it again." So now we shoot it over because Jim didn't like it, because every time he'd look over his shoulders, look back for the bad guy, and he'd turn around to cross the bridge, his face was in the horse's ass. So I said, "Jim, ain't my problem, man. Back up." So we did it again, you know, and it almost happened again, and so me and Jim almost rumbled over a horse's ass, you know. Things happen. You know, everybody wants their space.
Yeah.
With One Down, Two to Go, you added Richard Roundtree, but this time you produced and directed. What was that like?
Well, you know, again, it was hard to find money to put together a sequel that was so successful. Which makes Hollywood even more confusing. I mean, here's the Three to Highway was very successful. I'm out of trying to raise money to do the sequel to it, and it didn't happen through Hollywood, so I had to do, you know, private sources. And so in order to make sure that the film was a success, I threw in Richard Roundtree to make sure that the film was going to be a success, because we really didn't have a lot of money to make the film. But, you know, my image and career was at stake for me to make a film that didn't make money, because I've never made a film that didn't make money. So I put Roundtree in it to secure the fact that the film would be successful. And it was very successful.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's hard to understand Hollywood sometimes. Right? You know, money is green, and they don't seem to see totally the fact that money is green. It's still black and white in Hollywood.
Yeah. And did you always want to be a director, or was it an extension of the acting, or did it just grow out of necessity?
It grew out of necessity because it's cheaper. If I'm going to produce and direct and star, then I don't have to pay me. I mean, if you add all of my services to a $500,000 film and pay me nothing, then it's not really a $500,000 film. It's a $1 million film if I make $200 for directing and 200 for acting and 150 for producing. I mean, it's a $1 million film. It's not a $500,000 film. So I could get more on the screen by taking whatever money they give me and put it on the screen and not really put it in my pocket and count on my ability to make a good film that will pay me on at the end. So, you know, it's cheaper.
Yeah.
And after Three the Hard Way, Take a Hard Ride and One Down, was there ever talk of kind of continuing those films between you guys, or was Original Gangsters the next opportunity you had for that?
Original Gangsters was the next opportunity because, again, you know, we're bucking the system. We're doing something without needing the system. We're doing something that's not getting total major release, and yet and still we're being successful. So I think some of the films and the idea was a threat to what Hollywood was doing. I mean, here in New York, if my film was playing across the street that I made for $1 million, and on the other side of the street in New York is a film that costs $90 million, and I got a line outside of my theater, and they don't have a line outside of that theater, I'm taking money away from them.
Yeah.
And that's how they see it. That's how they view it. And, you know, too bad.
And right, exactly. I mean, you know, all those movies deserve to be, you know, classics as far as I'm concerned, and preserved for a long time. And hopefully they will continue to be as fans rediscover them, you know. But you have great defined all three of you guys who are in that main movie and Richard Roundtree, you all have these great defined on-screen personas. How true to your real life is that, either then or when you started out, or versus today?
Well, remember, you're talking to the hammer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm still pinching myself.
I didn't get that name from picking roses.
Right.
So, I got that name on the football field from trying to decapitate people. So I already had an image as a badass.
Yeah.
So when I decided to go into Hollywood, I was not going to give up an image that I had created in pro football. So I made I made that quite clear to the press when I first came in and did movies. I said, I got three rules. One, you can't kill me in a movie. Two, I have to win all my fights in a movie. And three, I get the girl at the end of the movie if I want it. Now, you satisfy two out of three of those, and I'm in your movie. Otherwise, I'm not for sale. You can't buy me. I'm not selling my integrity or my image, because I know what I stand for. I know what I stand for as a person. I know what I stand for in the black community. And I'm not willing to give that up for a few dollars, because after the money is gone and you've sold your image, you get nothing left.
Yeah. And that's a, you know, that's obviously a real strong message behind your heroic image on screen. And that on-screen persona has been really important to you. And is it still as important? Are you still as passionate about it now? Do you think in this day and age it's still as important?
Well, it's me. It's not as important. I'm sitting here smoking a cigar in front of the fireplace talking to you. And if anybody walks in the door that don't suppose to walk in that door, I can't tell you, you'll hear some screaming and it won't be me. So, you know, I am what I am.
No, indeed. I get it. So you did a lot of work. You mentioned earlier you obviously worked a lot in Europe, and that was sort of shortly after One Down, Two to Go, I think. Was that initial move, was that to do with the money aspect? Was there money out there, or were you interested in what was going on in European filmmaking?
Well, I had made several films even before that. Because I'd already been listening to the producers in Hollywood saying that blacks in films don't make money in the foreign market. And I never quite understood why they said that, because I had a lot of girlfriends from Germany and Switzerland and Paris and Rome. So I know they like me somewhere. So you can't tell me that they don't like me over there. So, okay. So what I did in 1973, 74, I made a film called Adios Amigo with Richard Pryor. And I took the film under my arm to Cannes, and I sit on the Carlton Terrace, and I gave the maitre d' $50 every day, 12 o'clock, to save me the same table right in the middle of the terrace during the lunchtime, where all the big shots and all the big producers came and showed off their wares and tried to be cool sitting on the terrace. And I had the table right in the center. I took my brochures. I laid my brochures out, spread them on the table. Had the T-shirt girls long before the T-shirt girls were popular, walking around with Adios Amigo on their T-shirts. First player came up was Greece. Greece says, we buy all Fred Williamson movies. We want to buy a film. Here's $3,000. I said, why is that? He says, I never pay more than $3,000. That's what the going price is over here for any film with a black star. It's $3,000. And I suddenly realized that this idea that blacks don't make films in Europe was being sold to the foreign market so they could sell them and the foreign market could buy them cheap. But they knew that it was a lie, so they did not help to change that image, because if they can buy them cheap, they would buy them cheap. So they didn't fight that $3,000 was a great buy. But before I left that week, he bought the film for $25,000. He promised not to go back and tell Hollywood what he paid for it, because he didn't want to change the image or the perception.
Yeah.
So it was something that Hollywood even still believes, that a film with a black star alone don't do business in Europe. You don't see many stars carrying a picture. Even Denzel Washington or Samuel Jackson rarely carry a film by themselves. There's always a white counterpart, whether it's female or male. I mean, they gave Denzel Washington American Gangster. American Gangster was nothing more than a ripoff of Black Caesar.
Right.
But he had a huge name. He had a big white counterpart, and the film really wasn't that good, and it really didn't do big business. So, you know, foreign market is a big market for me, because in Europe, I'm not a black actor. I'm an action star.
Yeah.
In America, I'm a black actor. That's a big difference.
Yeah, and it's a shame that there's a difference, because you can definitely see from your movies that you've done where you're just, like you say, just playing the action star rather than necessarily playing any other.
Well, I had an ongoing character in Rome in Italy called Black Cobra.
Right, exactly.
I played a cop. It's a dirty, hairy cop. That's all it is. You know, trying to sell that image here is impossible. Over there, they loved it.
Yeah.
Because it was a good movie, you know, and that's the criteria. If the movie is good, it's marketable. If it's not good, then it's not. They don't really give it that opportunity. I mean, he did it one time with Shaft, and then they came back and gave Shaft a television series with two white counterparts, some young blonde and a young white guy, which took away the total image of Shaft.
Yeah. No, completely. No, I agree. But do you have any from those European days of making, like, the Inglourious Basterds and the Bronx Warriors and movies like that? What are they like? What's it like being on an Italian set and the Italian directors? Is it different? Is it more exciting? Is there stories from those movies?
My first experience of doing a film was Inglourious Basterds, made in Rome. And first day on the set, everybody is talking and all the crew and everybody's making noise. And then when it comes time to shoot, the talking doesn't stop. They're ordering coffee and two creams and then they got an air camera that sounds like a washing machine, because they know that there's going to be dubbing afterwards, because they dub everything, and you're trying to concentrate on what you're doing. That was the most difficult thing I ever did in my whole life, was my first movie in Italy, listening to this loud camera and listening to everybody talking in the background. They don't care, because, you know, they want their performance, and they don't really care. I mean, that's why the films that are made in Europe don't really do big business over here, because we're spoiled. We like perfection. They don't mind that the voice and the mouth don't move at the same time. That doesn't bother them.
Yeah.
They're looking at the film and enjoying the actor and enjoying the cast, and that's what they're looking at. Here we're looking at perfection. You know, if the car door closes and there's no sound in the car door, you go, did you see that? There was no sound in the door. They don't do that over in Europe. That's not so big.
Yeah. Well, there's a certain group of fans over here, I think, and also in the UK who like those movies, who can see what those movies are. They look past the dubbing, or they look past the sound. They can see, you know, how much fun they are and what good times they are, I think. A lot of those, I think, with the new media, DVDs and Blu-rays and stuff, are getting a resurgence. As, you know, Bill Lustig, someone you've worked with, has his Blue Underground company that releases these kind of movies all the time. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, they got looked over so fast and never really got a chance to be exposed properly. I think that's where the reoccurrence is coming, you know, even with the music. When Black Caesar and Elton Harlan came, you know, and with the soundtrack of James Brown. Now the young people, a few years ago, hearing the music, saying, where did this music come from? It came from this movie, Black Caesar, Helping Harlem. And now they want to see it. So they go see Black Caesar and Helping Harlem. They go, wow, that's a pretty good movie. You know, any more around? So, I mean, it all helps.
Yeah, it's all getting refound all the time. I mean, you know, it's only in the last kind of 10 years that I've come to it, but I love all those movies, and I love your movies and Pam Grier's movies. And I feel like, although they might not have been given their due, I feel like they are important movies. Did you feel that there was a sense of excitement and importance at the time amongst the Black community putting these movies out there? Or was it just... was it just another movie? Was it just more work? Was it just... what were your feeling at the time?
No, not at the time they were being made, because at the time they were being made, it was the first surge of Black heroes, and there were no Black heroes. And the movies, Sidney Poitier was a great actor, but you certainly wouldn't consider him an action hero. He was a great actor, and that's all we had back in the day was Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. So there was a need, there was a vacuum for an Eastwood kind of guy or a Bronson kind of guy to step forward. So when I stepped into the ring and Rounsley did and Brown did, we fulfilled a void. And, you know, that's kind of like what propelled those movies, because now the Blacks had people they could root for. You know, the Black guy doesn't get killed in the first five minutes of the film, and then they avenge his death. You know, kill Schwarzenegger, let me avenge his death. You know, don't kill me in the first 5 minutes of the film.
Now that's a movie. You're killing Schwarzenegger and avenging his death.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One of the people you've clearly influenced is Quentin Tarantino. And you work with him on From Dusk Till Dawn. You've already said about your three rules that you don't die on film, you don't lose a fight, right, you get the girl. But did you change the rule for that film?
No, I knew that if I went down, I went down at something big and ugly, and that is a hammer. I went down at something after I had killed 35 vampires and did my thing, then I turned into this thing that looked like he hadn't had his morning coffee. So I didn't go down as the hammer. And you know, and it was respect that Quentin gave me, because he let me help write the stuff, create some scenes in there. Like, I know I'm a martial artist, so I said, listen, why don't I do some martial arts? He said, well, what do you want to do? Well, suppose one of these guys walk by, and as he's walking by, I say, whatever you got to say to him, say to me first. And he walks toward me, and I do a martial art move and take his heart out. So I'm holding his heart in my hand, but he's still walking. So Harvey Keitel stabbed it with a pencil. And that's how he killed the thing.
It's aggressive.
But, I mean, you know, Quentin obviously thinks a lot of me, because he did Inglourious Basterds. He copied Inglourious Basterds. He did The Django, which was The Legend of Nigger Charlie. Took my uniform, my outfit, my hat, my horse, my gun, everything, and did The Django with it. So, I mean, hey, there's some respect there that he hasn't really mentioned yet, but I'm sure quietly you say, hey, the hammer's pretty good.
You're clearly influenced him. What was the experience like being on set on From Dusk Till Dawn, working with Robert Rodriguez and you know, having that makeup on? What was that like?
I didn't really give a damn about watching Rodriguez or Quentin. You know, we got Selma Hayek. My eyes was on Selma Hayek. I didn't care about Quentin. I didn't care about Rodriguez. I'm watching Selma Hayek. Are you crazy? Then I'm trying to become friends with Selma. I spent the whole time trying to be friends with her.
Don't blame you, sir.
Quite right, too.
And looking back over your career, you've made over 100 movies. Are there any favourite roles that you've enjoyed playing? Or could you tell us?
What I've made sure is that, again, that the roles that I play fit within the realm of what I said. I don't sell my integrity. I don't do a role for the sake of being in the film unless it gives me what I want as far as image is concerned. Because I'm very concerned and careful about my image, baby. I mean, I can't lose a fight to some guy and then walk down a ghetto street in New York or in Chicago, and the guy says to me, brothers, pass me the street, say, hey, man, how you doing? Why you let that little guy beat you up in the movie? So, you know, that ain't going to happen. And I know that that's where my longevity is that there is no surprises in a Fred Williamson movie. You know what I'm going to do. You know how I'm going to do it. So there are no surprises. And that goes a long way. And whatever film that you're in, again, I refer back to Clint Eastwood. I refer back to Charles Bronson. As Charles Bronson got older, his gun got bigger. He started killing the bad guy with bazookas, if you remember. So his image didn't change. Even though he couldn't fight anymore, he got a bigger gun. So he compensated for that. So image, to me, is everything.
Excellent.
And are there any movies that you're particularly proud of as an actor, producer, or director, ones that really kind of stick out for you, ones that you would suggest if someone said, who's Fred Williamson? Which ones would you hand off and say to an audience they should see?
My favorite movie that I made, but again, they all fit the same image-wise, but my favorite movie, small movie that not many people even saw, it's called Joshua.
Right.
And these guys came riding into this little cabin and they did harm to my mother. And so I now got to seek them out one by one. And my favorite line in the movie is I get to the last guy, and I got him cornered in a cave. I hang some dynamite just out of his reach in the opening of the cave, and he started yelling, you know, who are you? Because he didn't understand why this guy on a black horse was following him around and killing his friends one by one. And my last line before I threw a bead on the dynamite and shot it was, he said, who are you? And I said, I'm my mother's son. And I blew him away. And to me, that's the best line in the whole movie. I'm my mother's son.
Yeah.
And took him out. Yeah.
Excellent. So everyone should go check out Joshua. And is there any ambition or anything you set out to achieve in this business or any business that you still have to do? Or is it all just about continuing your fantastic image and legacy?
You know, when I look back, I mean, I don't really feel like I've done anything. I mean, I'm just trying to move in a straight line. I don't have any great goals except to be continually creative in doing things that I want to do. I really don't feel that I've accomplished a lot because maybe I don't really know what my goal is, but I just want to keep moving forward and maybe one day I'll find it.
Well, as far as us film fans are concerned, sir, you have accomplished a hell of a lot. And is there anything apart from Original Gangsters 2 that you're working on that people can look forward to that's coming out soon?
Yeah, I finished a film in Berlin called, it was a film about Hitler hiding a atomic weapon in one of his bunkers. And the bad guys were out to get this weapon. And I had to get it before they did. I just want America to know that they're safe. I got it. The name of the movie is called Atomic Eden.
Oh, yeah.
And I finished one in Montreal called Billy Trigger.
Our friend, in fact, one of our friends who runs another show, Jason Hewlett, worked on Billy Trigger.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I'm looking forward to seeing that. He gets killed in it, so I'm looking forward to seeing it.
That's going to be a good one. That's going to be a good film.
Yeah, and I was actually reading up on Atomic Eden earlier before the interview, so I'm looking forward to seeing that when it comes out as well. And was there anything else you wanted to say on Original Gangsters 2?
No, I just hope that the fans realize that I'm trying to make the film for them because the film needs to be made, it needs to be seen. And, you know, whenever I tell people that I'm trying to do this film, Original Gangsters 2, their eyes light up, you know, like, when are you going to do it? When is it? I said, well, you know, we can't do it till we get the money. So it's a film, when you mention it, everybody wants to see it. So which excites me and wants me to get it done even more.
Okay, excellent. Well, we're definitely going to be spreading that word throughout January and into February. So thank you ever so much for your time today, Fred. That was absolutely wonderful interview. Thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate you guys giving me a chance to talk about it.
Oh, no, of course. Anytime. I could talk to you all night with a number of things, that number of movies.
It's been such an honor. Such an honor speaking to you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. All the best, sir.
Ciao. Ciao. Ciao, ciao.
Do you like movies? Do you like beards? Do you bathe in raw meat? Do you dance under the fiery sky of Ra, daisies threaded through your man-chest vein? Foolish question. Yes, we all do. But do you do it listening to the podcast from the After Movie Diner? If not, then you're missing out, and you may or may not spend eternity in insufferable torment, wedged between Simon Cowell and Piers Morgan in an elevator that smells of death. The After Movie Diner is a website dedicated to movies. New, old, large, small, and of every genre. There are written reviews, interviews with the famous and interesting, and a weekly podcast with comedy, reviews, interviews, a variety of fascinating and flatulent co-hosts, and music to tap your toe to. So why aren't you on board? Get there or miss out on the podcasting sensation of a generation. One that feels like being slightly tongued by an over-enthusiastic Cocker Spaniel. Find us on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, TalkShoe, and over at aftermoviediner.com.
Hi, I'm Steven Seagal. That's right, Steven Seagal. And for the past 40 years, in between barbecuing oxen and roasting boar for my insatiable appetite, I never miss an episode of Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid commentaries. Ain't that right, Johnny?
Hi, I'm Dr. Action.
Hi, and I'm the Kick-Ass Kid.
When I'm not watching action films, I'm usually polishing my gun while looking at a bat.
And when I'm not watching action films, I'm normally outside with a harpoon killing puppies.
But usually you can find us both watching 80s, 90s action films. You could follow us on Twitter, Dr. Action Kick-Ass.
You can find us on our main page, which is dractionkickass.blogspot.com.
You can also find us on iTunes and TalkShoe.
Yes, every week we do a commentary on an 80s and 90s action classic, and where we can, we also provide the film so that you can watch along with it.
This podcast explodes.
Hey, where's that baby mama at? I gotta tase somebody.